If you live in the Valley, you've seen the smiling face of Rich Rodriguez on your TV for years. But Rich and 40 other people would have never been born if his dad didn't survive the Battle of the Bulge, or if the mail hadn't caught up to him overseas.
We passed the flashlight around from one guy to the next, and to my greatest surprise of World War II, it was a letter from a young lady in Exeter.
Hear the rest of that story from Luis Rodriguez on Hometown Heroes, today at 1 on News Talk 580, or at 5 o'clock on FM 105.9. KMJ.
News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, with you every Saturday here on KMJ, whether you listen at 1 o'clock on the AM side, at 5 o'clock on the FM, or anytime at KMJNow.com. You know that each week we visit with World War II veterans. We want to, first of all, let them know how much we appreciate what they did so many years ago. We want to honor them for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so what they did is not forgotten. And along the way, we learn a thing or two. And I know we've got a lot to learn today from 86-year-old Luis Rodriguez. He'll be 87 next month. He and his wife, Marie, will celebrate their 64th anniversary next month as well. He is a longtime resident of Exeter in Tulare County. And that's where he was a long time ago when America got drawn into World War II. What do you remember about December 7th, 1941? Were you picking oranges or something like that?
We were picking oranges. I could take you to the spot where my brother and I were picking. And we were going into lunch, and some of the guys had gone to lunch early. And coming back, they had told us they turned the radio on in their cars and heard about the bombing at Pearl Harbor. And I was just a young kid, but I think about 16 years old, and I just couldn't believe that something like that could happen to the United States of America. It just couldn't sink in. So we hurried home and turned on our radio, and sure enough, everything was about what had happened at Pearl Harbor and the losses and everything that took place on that day. And this is something that I'll never forget.
Now, Exeter is not a huge city now, but it was an even smaller citrus town back then. How did things change around Exeter? You're in high school at the time. How did things change around Exeter after that news of Pearl Harbor?
At that time, I was a sophomore at Exeter High School, and one of my best friends was a Japanese fellow. I mean, he was another, to me, just another guy, another American student trying to get an education, and that's when he told me that they could not cross the Highway 65 or Kowee Avenue that faced the Exeter High School because of the restrictions. And he said, it's pretty soon they're going to take us away to somewhere we don't know when. And I said, you know, a guy as good as you are and coming from good parents, why are they doing this? But we learned later why it was done. And in my mind, I think it was the right thing because there was we were suffering a lot of losses in the Pacific, and I'm telling you, there was a lot of Americans that just couldn't stand to hear that their son or daughter had been killed in Japanese. It made them, you might say, hate the Japanese, and I think if any Japanese in our area, they might have been killed or injured seriously.
How long was it for you? You're 16 at that time. How long was it before Uncle Sam got a hold of you and put an end to your dreams of playing baseball for a while?
Well, like I said, I was about 16 years old, and at 18, I had to register for the draft. And when I was 18 years old and 6 months, they had me in uniform.
When you were drafted, when you had to put on that uniform, did you have an idea of what you were hoping to do, what things might be like in the Army?
No, I didn't. All I knew is that I knew I was just one of several million men that with the uniform of the United States, and I was going to wear it proudly and do my job as best I could, and God willing, I would live through it and come back to Exeter.
How hard was it to say goodbye to your family and go off to basic training and everything that you went through?
It wasn't easy, especially for my mother. She loved us kids, and she just wanted to keep us, and we could understand why. But to me, I said, you know, it's time to serve my country and do the best of my duty for my country.
I want to touch on one more thing before you left. I know that you're an 18-year-old kid at that time, and there are plenty of eligible women around Exeter, and you saw a young lady named Marie who caught your eye a little bit. Would she give you the time of day?
Not a bit. She had her thoughts in her mind. She had a different life that she thought she wanted to live. But a couple of years later, things began to change.
Yeah, and we'll get to that. Let's talk about the way your life changed in the Army. You would end up in the 240th Field Artillery Battalion. What was the moment that stands out in your mind where you really felt like, you know what, this is tough stuff. I'm in some thick future ahead here. I don't know how I'm going to hack it. What was the welcome to the Army moment for you?
It wasn't the greatest thing that ever happened that was positive. It was before me joining the 24th Field Artillery Battalion, I was shipped to Texas where I was training in a tank battalion. And just to say it in a few words, there was a commentator, news commentator by the name of Walter Winchell, and he called our camp the hellhole of the United States, and I agreed with him 100%.
What was so horrific about it?
The training. They made men out of boys. Training was almost 24 hours a day, night classes and daytime marching, and just, like I say, making men out of boys, especially the obstacle courses. I'll never forget that one. You had to go crawl on your back, and this was in January, mud and what have you. And with barbed wire, you picked up the barbed wire as you were crawling along on your back. And with explosives going on and a machine gun fire directly or over you, you could not raise your head over 6 inches because it might get shut off.
Yeah, and this, we're not talking dummy bullets and pretend explosives. This is live ammunition, and you could get killed in training.
You could get killed. There was one guy that, he's unbelievable, but he came up on a rattlesnake, and of course, in fear, he raised up, and that was the end of him. But we kept on, we went through it two times during the daytime, and the third time was at night, and that was tough going. And I'll never forget it. After all the rough training there, I was almost to the end of this obstacle when the bottom of my body went limp. I knew they were there because the guys were bumping into my legs that were crawling as I had been. And I tell them, go around me. I'm paralyzed from my waist down. I laid there for about a half an hour hoping that I'd overcome this. And God willing, I did, and I finished my crawling on my back.
Wow, I can't imagine what that must have felt like. And I bet there are a lot of nights there where you went to sleep saying, what I wouldn't give to pick 25 acres of oranges right now if I didn't have to be here, huh?
That's very, very true. But, you know, we were training for something that was tough ahead of us, and that's the only way that kept me going. I said, well, I'm training for something that I know will come in handy later on, and it did. Endurance was the word.
Well, and, you know, hearing that story about the lower half of your body going limp, it occurs to me if something like that happened to me, then moving forward, I'd be afraid of that happening again. Did you deal with that fear?
I thought of it more than once, but, you know, you have to keep going, keep going. That was the word, keep going. No matter what was ahead of you, you had to keep grinding away.
So they assign you to the 240th Field Artillery Battalion, and you end up as a powder man on a long tom, 155 millimeter howitzer. What is that like? How big of a gun is that? And what happens when it goes off?
Well, it's a big gun. It was a big gun. And when it went off, the gun blast was terrific. No matter where you always stood behind it, of course. But it was unbelievable, especially when we fired four guns at one time. It was just unbelievable. You had to be there to realize what it was to have four guns go off like that.
That's not something you only hear. That's something you feel all over your body, right?
Well, absolutely. I mean, we didn't have any ear protection, so we just put our fingers in our ears and closed our eyes and hoped for the best.
And these days, I think if you tell someone you're a powder man, they think you're putting on makeup in Hollywood or something. But what was a powder man on a 155 crew? What did you have to do?
Well, first of all, the command would come whether it was a charge super or a charge normal. So you put the charge into the barrel that was you were told to put in there. The full charge weighed 36 pounds, which wasn't too heavy for a kind of training we had, but you had to put it in the right end first, otherwise it wouldn't go off.
Any mishaps that you ever experienced trying to do your job correctly?
One time in combat, we had a fire mission of 2 rounds, and on the first round, it was at night, and everything went okay till the number one man went to fire the gun, and it wouldn't go off, and it took a cap to fire it to start the explosion. After numerous times, it wouldn't go off, so the word came to open the breech block, which was just as dangerous as could be. If it would happen then, would it blow us all up? The sergeant said, "Rodriguez, remove the powder charge." I said, "Sir, my training is to insert the powder charge, not to remove it." And he removed it, and it was all, everything went okay.
You could have lost a hand, an arm, everything, huh?
Everything, you know, you're up, everything in your upper portion with 36 pounds of dynamite going off at one time.
You mentioned combat. I'm curious about your state of mind before combat. Were you itching to get over and fight somebody after the training you'd been through? Were you anxious about getting overseas? How would you remember your mindset?
No, I wasn't anxious to get overseas, but I wasn't going to back up for anything. I knew it was, you know, I wasn't alone. We had, our battalion consisted of 500 men, and when 500 men are willing to do it, why should one say no? No, we were trained soldiers, and we did our job as ordered to.
And during this time, in World War II, the Army was segregated. If you were African-American, you were in an all-black unit, generally. If you were Japanese, you were in an all-Japanese-American unit, the 442nd famously fighting over there. As a Hispanic-American, did you ever feel any different than anybody else, and were you treated the same as the Caucasian soldiers?
No, we all wore the same uniform, and we consider ourselves all equal. Although the Hispanic population, I should say, in our battalion was very, very minimal. I had 500 men. I think there was 5 Hispanics. In our battery of 100 men, I was the only Hispanic. So I was just one of the guys.
And everyone treated you fine?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
So what was it like to head overseas? I mean, you are still a young man. You're seeing the world in a way I guess you didn't plan on. What do you remember about heading over?
Well, you know, after going through all that you've trained, that you've gone through, you got to say, I don't want to waste it. I want to go over there and do my job as I've been trained to do, and do the best I can to face what obstacles I need to, what I have to, I had look can look forward to having to face. I felt that I was prepared.
Had you ever been on a ship before?
No. No. My first ship ride was going across the Atlantic Ocean. Fortunately, we went in the Queen Elizabeth, which had all troops, and it was 15,000 of us men in that ship, and men and women, of course, and a few civilians, government people. It was so big that the waves didn't affect it very much, so it was a very smooth ride. The only thing I thought was, if this ship goes across by itself, no escort, no nothing, I hope it gets across that water.
And it did, and you were fine by the time you got there. What was your first experience of combat? What was your baptism by fire, if you will?
Well, number one, lay low. Hope that we find the enemy that's shooting us at that time and do our best to destroy it. And that's what we did.
And where and when was that?
It was in France. Our first combat was in what they call the Argentan-Falaise Gap. That was the first big encirclement of enemy troops. We captured almost 15,000 of the enemy in this encirclement.
And your gun crew's firing away, but the German artillery is firing toward you, I imagine. Do you remember how close incoming fire came to you?
No, in our first combat in Argentan-Falaise, the enemy was just about wiped out as far as any big artillery pieces. So it went very smooth as far as our part was concerned.
So that was the first taste, but it was certainly not the last. We're going to take our first commercial break, but when we come back, we're going to hear about how Luis Rodriguez experienced the Battle of the Bulge. How did he stay warm at night? How did he sleep? And how did he survive? We'll get that story when Hometown Heroes continues next on KMJ.
It's as simple as ABC, friends, no teeth.
I can remember hearing that jingle on the radio for years, but I didn't really understand what it meant until redoing my shower a couple years ago. This is Paul Leffler, proud to welcome Fresno Distributing as a sponsor of Hometown Heroes here on KMJ. The knucklehead who tiled my shower, that would be yours truly, left a decent-sized hole around the shower arm. I needed an oversized flange to cover it, and I went all over town. None of the chain stores had what I needed. Finally, a merciful soul asked me, "Have you tried Fresno D?" Fresno D, as in duh, why didn't I think of that in the first place? So I quickly took the 41 to the McKinley exit, walked into Fresno Distributing, and bumped smack dab into the owner, Steve Cloud. He said he was sure they had exactly what I needed, and of course, he was right. Now I make Fresno D my first stop, whether I'm looking for one of those obscure plumbing parts or a top-of-the-line appliance, like the new Electrolux energy-efficient washer and dryer set my wife picked out. They have all the other top brands, too. Don't make the mistake I did. If you want your first stop to be your last stop, make a beeline for Fresno D. And while you're there, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes on KMJ. A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis. Its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K-12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We continue now with 86-year-old Luis Rodriguez of Exeter, California, served with the 240th Field Artillery Battalion in World War II, including what we know now as the Battle of the Bulge, but you'd never heard of it at this point. Winter's coming on. And as a child of the San Joaquin Valley, I imagine you hadn't been exposed to freezing cold temperatures before. What was your first encounter with the kind of cold you'd never seen before?
Well, like I say, it was cold. And the clothing that we had was not sufficient for the temperature that we were facing. But we made the best out of it and did our best to stay warm and stay alive, although it seemed impossible. Of course, the temperatures dropping down to below zero, as much as 20 at some times. Why, even our guns had a bad effect of it, because having hydraulic mechanisms in it to lower and raise it and traverse the gun barrel, why they contained oil, and this oil got so cool that it couldn't sustain the temperature and it would freeze up, and we had to call our guns out of order. And it's something that, you know, I had never faced in my life before, to have this kind of cold. It gets cold in California. You all know, aware of it, but not like it did during the Battle of the Bulge. It was very, very cold.
What all did you have to try to stay warm, and where were you expected to sleep?
Well, first of all, they issued us some sleeping bags that were made for about 50-degree weather, which was nothing for the kind of weather we had. But, you know, you have to seek for yourself sometimes, and I was able to find some civilian blankets and I had two government-issued blankets, and I folded them together and made my own homemade sleeping bag, plus finding some canvas that I folded over, and it kept me fairly warm. It wasn't as bad as not having these items, but still, you had to either sleep with your shoes on or you wouldn't be able to put them on in the morning. If you take them off, I usually use them sometimes for my pillow. Sometimes I just put them in the bottom of my bag to keep them warm so that they wouldn't be frozen in the morning. But it got me by, and we did the best we could with what we had to keep going.
And how was your unit drawn into the Battle of the Bulge? What do you remember about that?
At the beginning of on December the 16th, I'll never forget this day because I volunteered for advanced duty. We were in the northern section of the first Army, which we were in. And I volunteered for advanced duty, so our job was to go up to the front and select new gun positions for our guns. And arriving at this place, I could see that somebody made a mistake. Our infantry had not taken the hill in front of us, and it wasn't long that they saw our truck arrive, I guess, and they started making shots at us. One of them came very close. If it hadn't been for a wall that I was behind this wall, I wouldn't be here because it destroyed the wall, but it didn't hurt any of us guys.
These were the infamous German 88s firing at you?
Yes, it was a German 88. They kept firing at us, but the difference between our artillery and what I experienced of their artillery, we had a target. We would put at least 4 guns on it. We had 12 guns, so you couldn't miss. They used 1 gun, and and we realized at this point that we wouldn't be able to take this, bring our artillery in, so they had us go back, and all the way back it fired us for about a couple of miles, and you could just see these shells exploding to our left or to the right, but thank God no direct hits.
What was going through your mind during that time? It probably seemed to last a lot longer than it really did.
It lasted longer than I wanted to, but we were glad when we went over this hill where they couldn't see us anymore and they quit firing on us.
And the Bulge was not over in a hurry. That was December 16th. It would rage on for another 40 days approximately. What was the toughest thing that you faced during that time?
The toughest thing that we faced was putting up with the cold. They went to the forest putting thermometers on our ammunition, on our gunpowder, to see how, because the cold will definitely drop the efficiency of the gunpowder. And I remember this one night, one of the other guns were using the thermometer, and the next morning they looked for it and they couldn't find it. They said, "We must have fired that thermometer at the Germans throughout the night."
And I imagine those big heavy guns were not too easy to maneuver in the snow.
Well, as long as we had traction with our tractors to move them, it wasn't bad. It was much, much better in the snow than in frozen ground than it was in the mud, because in the mud they were kind of teeter-totter, and it was just very difficult to get them raised up for march order.
You know, our culture today obviously is familiar with the wars in Iraq and now Afghanistan, but I don't know how many people realize that there were more Americans killed in the Battle of the Bulge alone than in those two wars combined. Did you see any evidence of the great loss of life there at the Battle of the Bulge?
Yes. You know, sometimes you see mounds, you know, small mounds in the snow. You think, well, you know, it must be some dirt raised up, but it wasn't. It was bodies that were frozen, laid there in the snow, and you dig them out, and there was a body there that was either killed or died from the cold.
And how do you live day to day in an environment like that, and not feel like you could be next, or that the future looks a little bleaker for you?
Well, all you can do is just put up with it and do the best that you can, and hope that somebody else doesn't find you in a mound like that.
Were there some days where you wondered?
Yeah, there were some days that were short-lived, but I'm still here.
When did you realize the significance of what you and all those other Allied soldiers accomplished at the Bulge?
Well, any time we advanced forward, we knew that we were accomplishing, that we were pushing the enemy back. And sometimes it was, we'd be in one's position for a couple of weeks or more. And towards after the Battle of the Bulge, and you know, early spring, and things got better, and we were moving quite frequently, and we knew that this was, even though it meant more work for us to get this gun ready to move and get it moved and set into position for firing, we knew that we were reaching a goal that sooner or later it would be a goal that we would accomplish and things would be over.
And I'm sure you thought often about when would it be over. I don't want to dwell too much on the death and destruction, but did you get desensitized to it at all? Did you ever get comfortable with it? Or did it really hurt when you saw someone that you knew or someone that could have been you and you found out that they weren't going to go home from the war?
Well, I think you kind of reach the point that you're going to live with it. And unfortunately, it's him, and you're glad that it's not you. But we just have to keep going. We can't stop. And that's just my thoughts were to just hopefully I can live through it and be able to come home when all this was over.
Had you been hearing from home at all?
Sometimes we would be moving. We were quite mobile. Even though we were First Army troops, if the Third Army needed us, why... needed artillery, whether we would help them out, and we had another army, 9th Army, to the north of us that we also supported them whenever they were needed. And sometimes we would be attached to an armored division, and we were directly under their command and doing what was they ordered us to do.
Did you have any sense, as you're in the midst of these battles, your gun crews are firing away, the incoming fire's coming at you, did you have any sense of the big picture and what was going on in the war and whether or not you guys were getting any closer to wrapping it up?
There was question at times. There was, our lines weren't moving. We don't know what's the matter and but it was just the resistance. And we were always, except for the Battle of the Bulge, we were always moving forward and pushing the enemy back, but we knew that there would be a day that it would be over, because when you consider the fact that the Germans, when they had started their first conflict in Poland and some of those small nations, and how they went into North Africa, and then they were back in their own country and being pushed, we knew there would be an end to it.
Now, what's this I hear? Now, your son, Rich Rodriguez, has been on television in the Valley for a long time. A lot of people know his name, know his face. He's been in their living rooms, their bedrooms at night for years. And he would have never been born if he didn't make it home from the Bulge. But he tells me you once had to interrupt a battle for a really strange reason. And maybe people have been driving around the Valley and had to stop on the road because... a cow wandered onto the road, but I've never heard of a cow stopping a war. What happened there?
It was during the spring. I don't recall where we were at, but somewhere in Germany. And here comes an old gent leading his cow to the barn. And it so happened that right in front of our guns, our 4 guns, the cow decided it was time, and she just went down and it was time to have her calf. Well, you know me, living here in San Joaquin Valley in Exeter, why, all I knew was oranges and grapes. But we had some guys from the Midwest that lived in cattle farms, and a couple of them went over there and helped this poor old guy get his calf delivered. And in the meantime, we had a fire mission to fire our guns, and we called our 4 guns out of commission, and they asked them, well, what's wrong? They said, well, there's a cow right in front of us having a calf. So these guys went helping the farmer, and they got the calf delivered and put him in a wheelbarrow that the old farmer went and got, and they led the cow and the calf through the barn, and we called our guns back into action, and we always said that we stopped the war so that a cow could have a calf. And I always wondered, would the Germans have done that for us had it been on the other side of the world?
Well, yeah, I wonder if there's a story like that out there somewhere. And, you know, it makes me think, I've heard some stories about that Christmas, and you spent your Christmas in 1944 in the midst of the Battle of the Bulge. Do you remember anything specific about that Christmas and what it felt like to be so far away from family and any sense of normal?
You know, we didn't have very much time to think about things like that. We were there shooting, firing away at the enemy, and keeping them from advancing any further than they had. And we just did our job, and the ammunition was not very plentiful because all our supply depots had moved back, and they really, nobody knew where they were at, but they brought us enough ammunition to keep us going and stop the enemy. And it wasn't long after Christmas. By January, we knew that we were back on the offensive again, and we knew they were, one thing to do is to push them back to where they belonged. And we were, by January the 25th, we were very successful in recovering all the land that we had lost.
For you and your unit specifically, how constant was the combat? And does labeling that time in your life as exhausting do it justice?
When you're like a horse pulling a wagon, well, you just can keep pulling the wagon and as long as you're able to. And that was us. We fired away as often as we were ordered to. Sometimes there were some lull times that it was kind of, you might say, quiet. But whenever we were the phone rang, we knew it was a fire mission, and we were prepared to perform our duties.
And you would keep doing that for a while yet. We're going to hear some more stories of Luis Rodriguez's experience in the Army during World War II. And what about that young lady back in Exeter? Did he ever hear from Marie again? We're going to get the answer to that story as Hometown Heroes continues after this on KMJ. What do you think of when I say Fresno D? Probably that catchy little jingle, right?
It's as simple as ABC, Fresno D.
Paul Leffler here to tell you what it means to me. It means Fresno Distributing selection of top-of-the-line appliances at wholesale prices for you, me, and everybody means you don't have to go anywhere else. Since I started hosting Bulldog Coaches shows in Fresno D's showroom a few years back, I've gotten to know the owner, Steve Cloud, quite well. I know that some of his favorites are King Tut, Coca-Cola with real sugar in it, and of course the Bulldogs. I know not to challenge him in gin rummy because he's a former world champion, no joke. But the other thing I know, and here's why my wife and I picked out our new Electrolux washer and dryer there, I know the Cloud family has been carrying the best appliances you can find anywhere since 1946. Bosch, Frigidaire, Maytag, Jennair, KitchenAid, Wolf, you name it. They have it. Don't just take my word for it. Go see for yourself at Fresno Distributing on McKinley between Blackstone and 41. Plumbing, lighting, electrical, kitchen, bath, whatever you need, Fresno D has it. And you won't find friendlier or more knowledgeable service anywhere. A locally owned business with great prices, great selection, and great service. Why go anywhere else? Still as simple as ABC, Fresno D.
Hey, this is Paul Leffler, and if you've been listening to KMJ for any length of time, you've probably heard me wax poetic about my hometown of Las Banas at one point or another. Every city has its secrets, and I'm going to fill you in on one my old neighbors have been keeping for 40 years. No matter where you live in the valley, you probably go through Las Banas every once in a while. So next time you're cruising down the 152, pull into Ming's Restaurant. The owner, Paul Cito, has been showing off his skills in the kitchen there since 1968. He has perfected the best Mongolian beef this side of the Great Wall. Delicate rice noodles underneath tender slices of beef with a flavor I can't even put into words. Whether you prefer mild, medium, or spicy, you'll be coming back for more. Ming's is closed on Mondays, so don't say I didn't warn you. But stop in any other day and try the pork wonton soup, Chinese chicken salad, or get everyone's attention with the sizzling chicken and vegetables. The possibilities are endless, but they all have one thing in common. Ming's time-tested commitment to taking your taste buds on a thrill ride. Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in Las Banas.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. If you want to get a look at the way our guest today, Luis Rodriguez, looked back in World War II and what he looks like today, you can go to our website at kmjnow.com. You can also check out the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. We've heard about the Battle of the Bulge. If he didn't survive the Bulge, he never would have returned to marry his wife, their 5 children, 17 grandchildren, 20, soon to be 21 great-grandchildren would have never been born. That's a lot to think about. We're going to continue now with the World War II story of Luis Rodriguez. After the Bulge, you guys are moving through Europe, and the Rhine River is separating line in Europe that's been fought over for centuries and centuries and tons of wars. And you would come to the banks of the Rhine as well and saw a little history yourself. Tell me about that.
This was in the spring of 45. We were moving forward, and we were told we were getting near the river, Rhine River, and we were told to go into position. And so we pulled off the road and went into a combat position, and they told us that the bridge was still intact. There was a bridge, the Lubendorf Bridge, they call it. It was a railroad bridge that our infantry had arrived, had reached it, and they said that the bridge was still intact. So they called the engineers to go over there and take all the destructive mechanisms they had on it, you know, gunpowder and dynamite and stuff. And they removed it, and the order was to reach the Rhine River and turn to the right and get and establish a beachhead. But being that the bridge was still intact, by they didn't have the orders to cross, so the word went back to command to see what they could do. And some officers said, "The hell with them, let's cross that bridge." So they put the engineers to clear everything, and our tanks started crossing. And history tells me that it was 4 hours before the command came to cross the bridge. In the meantime, the engineers built a pontoon bridge across the river in case that bridge, even though it was weak, supplies were still crossing it. And it was a few days that finally the bridge just collapsed from bombardment that it had received prior to us arriving there. But the thing that stands most in my mind is when they start crossing that bridge, I looked back, and as far as you could see was U.S. Army tanks lined up getting ready to cross that bridge and form a breachhead on the opposite side of the river. And at night, the Germans would try to bomb our pontoon bridge out. And by that time, we had got a lot of anti-aircraft guns on both sides of that river and protecting that bridge. And it was so much ammunition from the anti-aircraft guns going off that you could almost read a newspaper at any hour of the night with so much protection. I don't think a fly could have flown through all the firing that was going on.
And I guess you've probably never seen a fireworks show quite like it since, huh?
Never in my life. No, never.
When you think back on the close calls that you experienced in the service, what are the ones that stand out the most?
Well, I hate to say this, but it happened here in the States. We were practicing taking a town in training. There was A and B and C squads, and I was in B squad, center squad, and they were pulling up targets in front of us at a distance. Of course, they pulled up one target that was to my extreme left, and the guy on the, a soldier on the C section, he fired at it just as I was approaching, and his bullet just barely seized my ear. And I learned then, boy, don't be the first one there, let somebody else shoot first. But that was as close I ever got by a bullet. But in artillery, we didn't have very much of a close order, but mostly it was concussions from the big artillery guns that the Germans had. But there was one that was real close to me, and it shattered stuff on us, but nothing in small guns.
When you say very close, how close was the impact crater of that shell?
Oh, it was probably about maybe 10 feet from where I was, but there was a wall between it and me, and it shattered the wall, but it didn't hurt me, thank goodness.
Enough to get your attention, though.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
And what about the hand grenade? Now, we're told not to play with matches. I'm sure in the Army they told you don't mess around with hand grenades unless you mean it.
Just happened this way, that one of my buddies picked up a hand grenade that had been laying in the mud, and he screwed the firing device off of it and took out all the powder that was within it, and then screwed the deal back together, and he pulled a pin, his look rod, and it went click, and that was all that happened. A few days later, I happened to find the same hand grenade that was been left behind, And I did exactly the same thing as he had done. And I turned chicken in the last second, and I threw it into a, I pulled the pin and then held it in my hand, and in the last second I threw it into a foxhole and it exploded. Had I had it in my hand, I would be minus one hand at least, I'm sure.
Or minus a life and five kids, 17 grandkids, and 20 great-grandkids.
That's very true, very true. But I guess the Lord was on my side again and told me get rid of it.
Well, you said you turned chicken. I guess you can tell everybody that being chicken saved your life.
Absolutely, absolutely.
As the end of the war drew close in Europe, VE Day comes along. How did you find out that the war in Europe was over, and what kind of day was that for you?
Well, you know, we really didn't know. Our last day in combat was May the 1st, and we had been advancing very, very fast. Normally in artillery, you're at least there in one position about a week and sometimes more. And here we were moving every day, and every day we were out of reach of the enemy, so we just continued moving. This constituted a lot of work, but we knew the meaning of it. And on this May the 1st, that morning, early in the morning, we fired our last shot. It was one of those wet days. It had been snowing, and of course, it was warmer weather. The snow was melting and made the ground very, very muddy. But we were supporting the 14th Armored Division, a good division, and along with the 99th Infantry Division. And they were some of their troops more or less stayed where we were at. And we were wondering what in the world's going on. We're not moving, no orders, no nothing. So what had happened was that the front was moving so fast that the armored division no longer needed us. So they retired us from duty, and we were told to go back and establish a place to stay until we were called. And knowing what was going on, we knew better. That we had fired our last shot in Europe, and that's the way it was.
Now, you have a frame of General Dwight Eisenhower's Order of the Day from May 5th, 1945, when he talks about the crusade that the Allies had been on since the summer of 44, reaching its glorious conclusion. Do you remember hearing those words or reading those words from your commander and feeling anything specific about that?
I sure do. I'll never forget that day. It was an article in we used to get a newspaper whenever we could get it, Stars and Stripes newspaper, and on it was in the front page was this letter written from General Eisenhower, and it was something that we had dreamed up for 9 months, and here the day had arrived that all guns had gone to rest and we no longer needed to fire anything, and we wondered what our next duties would be, and we didn't take us long to find out. We were pulled into occupation of Germany.
Were you at all concerned that you might be sent to the Pacific?
Oh, yes. That was part of the soon order came that us low pointers, as we were called, would be training. They sent us to Czechoslovakia for training, and we were preparing for a trip to the Pacific to try and finish the war over there, which none of us wanted to go there. We felt we had done our job in Europe, and it was up to them to do their job and finish that war in the Pacific. But because of the bomb, we all said the war is over.
So in a way, it seems like VJ Day, Victory Over Japan Day, in August of 45 was maybe even bigger for you than Victory in Europe Day.
Oh, absolutely, because we knew then that we wouldn't be going to the Pacific. Sooner or later, we'd be coming home, and those were my hopes, to come back to Exeter.
When you came home, you would have a few souvenirs with you. One of them is remarkably well preserved. It still has the bright red pigment with a black swastika in the middle of a white circle. Where'd you get that flag?
Well, fortunately, it was in France that I picked it up. It was out of a German command car that had been strafed and destroyed by our airplanes. And in it, I saw I call it a cubbyhole, and in it was this German flag, and I kept it throughout the war and brought it home and gave it to my dad, and in his last days, he said, "This belongs to you," so he gave it back to me, and I still have it and well preserved.
And when you look at it, what does it signify to you? What does it remind you of?
It brings a lot of thoughts into my mind from the time that the Germans started their warfare in 1939, and here it wasn't but a few years later that I participated, and for one purpose, to defeat the enemy, and it was Germany.
And that's not the only thing that reminds you of how insidious that enemy was. You, during your occupation duty, one of the places you were stationed was Dachau, the site of an infamous concentration camp where Jews were tortured and killed. What did you see there? I mean, the inmates of that camp were long gone, but I'm sure the stench of what happened there lingered. What did you experience there?
Well, it was pretty well cleaned up by the time we arrived there, but the crematorium were still there, and the gas chambers were still there. Everything was intact. It became a museum, and you could see the torture, especially a tree that was there. Then some, I forget how many thousand people were hung on that tree. And then they also had places where they make the people kneel down, and a guard would shoot them from the back of their head, and they would fall into this trench that they had dug there.
And there was still a pile of ashes there that you could see?
Oh, yes. When they cleaned the crematoriums out, there was a lot of ashes, and they had them all piled up, and it was a tremendous pile of human ashes. That unbelievable. That just couldn't believe that people could be tortured in this capacity.
What did that do to you to have to see that and experience that just in the aftermath of it? I mean, it sounds like a real weighty thing to encounter.
Well, you know, you just wonder, like I say, how could a human destroy humans in this capacity, especially the people that had been there for so many years, starving to death and overworked and all that goes with the mistreatment of human beings.
Well, let's move on to happier subjects. I want to ask you about the letter you received before you came home, but also you guys were treated occasionally by things that were supposed to boost your morale, like USO shows, and you had one of the greatest dancers ever come and perform for the troops?
Oh, yeah. Occasionally we have what they call USO shows. They were people from the States coming to entertain the troops in combat. And one of them that I attended was Fred Astaire had a troop that pretty girls and dancers and all that, and they would perform under the most unusual conditions. And I remember one time he had to keep his, Fred Astaire couldn't put his dancing shoes on because of the climatic conditions and the floors where he had to dance. But we were all glad to see it, even though sometimes we were just on the go and just stop by there for maybe half an hour and observe the show that he had for us.
Did those kinds of things accomplish their purpose? Did it allow you to take your mind off of the gravity of what you were doing over there?
Oh, yes. I mean, it made you feel good inside that people were, you know, they went out of their way to entertain us, and you had to appreciate that.
We talked a long time ago about before you left Exeter for the service, you had tried to get the attention of a young lady named Marie, but she wouldn't give you the time of day. And you were a little surprised to see who signed a letter you received while at war. Tell me about that.
Towards the end of World War II, sometime in, I guess it was about April, that our mail finally caught up with us, and they said mail call. And another soldier and I just offered to go pick up our mail. And like I say, it was one of the coldest and the blackest nights I ever experienced in Europe. You could not see your hand in front of you. So they told us to keep walking down this trail until we heard familiar voices. And that's what we did. And they let us in, and we picked up our mail and went back to our guns. And we only had one flashlight, and it was all blackout. We passed the flashlight around from one guy to the next. Read the mail, and to my greatest surprise of World War II, it was a letter from a young lady in Exeter named Marie Franco that had written me a letter, her first letter to me, and it really made me feel good to receive a letter from her. So a few months when I got home, that was the lady I had to go see, and 2 years later, we were married, and a new life started on that day for me, for us, I should say.
And you've been married ever since, 64 years this May. Well, obviously, that gave you motivation to get home and see her. Do you still have that letter, by the way?
No, I'm sorry to say that I don't have it. I wish I'd have kept it. But she's kept all the letter that I wrote to her, and she wants me to remember that she was a gal for me and I was a guy for her, and that's the way it has been since 1948.
What was it like just to get home again and to be able to move on with a life you, for a while, you weren't sure you would ever have the chance to live?
It was the greatest feeling when we arrived in New York. You know, I'd been overseas 19 months. The first thing that was offered to us was a glass of U.S. milk. It really went down my throat, soothing it all the way down, because we hadn't had any milk all the time I was overseas.
You should have milked that cow after it had the calf.
I think the calf beat me to that.
So you had a glass of milk and never tasted anything better, huh?
That's very, very true. And then the next best thing that came along was the word came out that all those living west of the Mississippi River would get to fly home, and I was one of them. We didn't have any big transports like we have today, but that C-47 transport plane did the job from New Jersey to Sacramento, California.
And to see your family again?
And a couple of days later, I was discharged, and I knocked on the door where my parents lived at 2 o'clock in the morning, and I remember one of my sisters saying, "It's Lewis, he's home." That was good to hear.
When you think back on it now, with everything you went through, everything you've been able to experience since, what are you most thankful for?
I'm most thankful for the good Lord that kept me alive, and my mother's prayers that got me home safely, and all the good things that have gone throughout our married life that has been so great, and thanksgiving to our good Lord for all that has happened.
Now, you just had Easter, and you had dozens of family members around, and grandkids and great-grandkids. If one of them ever asked you, what were you doing in World War II? What was that all about? What's the best answer you can give them?
Well, I keep it short. I said I was in there for 30 months, and I did the best I could, but the best day was when they gave me my discharge papers.
Ever ask you why it was so important, or do you have an opinion on why it's important for us to remember it today?
Oh, I hope that our young generation never forgets this. I hope it's up to the educators to educate our kids and never let them forget World War II. I do my best to perform, to talk to different in the schools where I'm asked to speak on World War II, and even clubs had asked me to speak for them and talk about World War II.
You know, most of the veterans I interview are very reluctant to hear the label hero thrown their way. But oftentimes, they're not shy about telling me somebody they served with was a hero in their eyes. Did you have anyone in your time in the service that you really admired or looked up to as being very courageous?
Yes, we had a soldier come into our unit that had been in the Army for over 10 years. He was a regular Army man, and he was a regular Army man, and he was a man. I had high respect for him, for how he behaved and performed as a soldier.
And I'll get Marie's answer on this in a minute, but almost 64 years of marriage now. What's the secret?
There's no secret, just one day at a time. Every day, try to make it better than yesterday, and that has been our life. And always look forward, don't look back.
Well, we don't want it to be a one-sided story here, so let's get Marie Rodriguez to chime in a little bit. What changed your mind about this young man that you hadn't paid much attention to back in Exeter?
Oh, I decided that maybe I should change my opinion on the way I looked towards life, and I thought, well, I'll just write him a letter and see what happens when he comes home.
Did it work out the way you hoped it would?
Yes, it did. More than I ever hoped it would.
When you look at the pictures of that young man you married and the pictures of him in uniform and what he went through in the war, what does that make you think of, and what's your take on all of that?
Well, I thought to all the ones that fought in the war, you know, some were young, some were old, that they're, you know, brave people having to put up with the conditions that they had to undergo, and and try to protect our country and the privilege of us being able to live free.
Would you say before the war he seemed like a boy to you?
Yeah. To me, he was very wild. I didn't really care for his friends, or, of course, I never went out with boys, so I guess that's why I thought that way.
When he came back, he seemed a little more mature?
Yeah, he seemed very mature. Very mature. He had changed a lot.
And what would you say the secret is for a marriage that has lasted 64 years and you're not done yet?
Well, one thing I'll say is that he was more patient than I was. And I think the first few years that it was his patience that got us through the first few years of our marriage. Because I was very temperamental, and just one little thing would make me mad, and I just seemed like I just couldn't control it. But then as time went by, well, I decided that it was the best way was to try to both live together and be good to each other.
With all the stories you've heard him tell over the years about his time in the Army, is there something that amazes you or is most impressive to you?
I think just them going through the conditions that they went through, and the cold and being shot at and trying to stay alive. I think that's amazing to me. And then also all the friends that he made, the good friends, that they've stayed in contact with each other for so many years and had their friendships, and they were all like a family.
Anything else you want to share?
No, I'm proud of my husband. I'm proud of my children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. And I think we're a wonderful family. And we're always pretty close-knit, all of us, and we share a lot of different celebrations through the year and get together, and it's just a wonderful thing to experience in life.
You have any quick story you want to embarrass Rich with?
No, I don't think so, not at this time. He's been a good boy. We love him, and he was here with us today, had lunch with us, and I always look forward to having my children come and visit us, because we always look forward to it and enjoy the company very much.
When you watch the news, what channel do you watch?
There's only one, 26.
And you don't have to stay up as late as you used to, huh?
That's correct.
Well, hey, I just want to thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us some of those stories and letting us know. You talked about the importance of educators. You've been a big educator for our audience today, and we appreciate it.
Thank you very, very much.
That is Luis Rodriguez of Exeter, California. He'll be 87 soon. And now when you watch Rich Rodriguez on the KMPH 10 o'clock news tonight, you'll know where he got that humble, easygoing approach of his. We're out of time, but join us again next Saturday for another edition of Hometown Heroes on KMJ.